of journalism is to question the prevailing wisdom. Question the prevailing wisdom.
Just speak the truth, the whole truth, and nothing but the truth.
All rights reserved and affirmed.
Free of all minds. These are weapons of mass descent.
These are weapons of mass descent.
Welcome to Uprising, a daily digest of independent news analysis, investigation, education, artistic expression, and activism. It's Friday, August 27th, 2010, and I'm your host, Sonali Kolhatkar.
It just makes me stop and think. Silence is not an option.
Human rights groups take issue with the U.S.'s self-evaluation of human rights in the U.S., New Orleans 5 years after Katrina, and the 40th anniversary of the Chicano moratorium and the death of Ruben Salazar, plus Black Agenda Report. But I can't help myself, why should I? This is Uprising. Good morning and welcome to Uprising. Organizations nationwide are responding to a report on human rights that the U.S. submitted to the U.N. earlier this year, but just released publicly on August 23rd. All 192 member states of the United Nations are tasked with submitting the self-evaluation called the Universal Periodic Review to the UN Human Rights Council every 4 years. The UN Human Rights Council was created in March of 2006. The report requires each nation to identify both its perceived strengths and weaknesses in all areas of human rights. The participants are then expected to attend a hearing where 47 member nations review their submitted report. The U.S. will attend its first review on November 5th of this year. In its first report, the U.S. addressed a wide range of issues from race and gender, freedom of speech and national security, to housing and education. The government conceded that there was room for improvement in many areas. For example, in addressing issues of racial inequality, the report noted that the current foreclosure crisis has disproportionately affected communities of color, and it credits predatory and discriminatory lending practices as being partly to blame. However, the U.S. Human Rights Network, a group comprised of civil and human rights organizations, said in a press release that the report, quote, falls short of acknowledging the persistent infringements of human rights in the U.S., and the corrective measures touted in the report do not go far enough to guarantee a timely and thorough fix. Individual member organizations have also released evaluations and recommendations pertaining to their areas of focus. One such member organization is the National Law Center on Homelessness and Poverty, which calls on the United States to affirm housing as a human right and proposes specific changes in policy to address the present housing crisis. From the Law Center in Washington, D.C., we have on the phone this morning Eric Tars. He is the Human Rights Program Director and Children and Youth Staff Attorney. Welcome to Uprising.
Good morning. Thank you.
Thanks so much for joining us. So your organization in the National Law Center on Homelessness and Poverty, did you focus primarily on the areas of homelessness and poverty that the U.S. covered in its report to the U.N.?
Exactly. So under the process, nonprofit organizations, civil society organizations such as ours are allowed and, in fact, encouraged to participate in the process by creating what are known as shadow reports. We could submit up to 10 pages of information on issues of concern to us, and so we focus on those issues, housing and poverty, and the shortcomings that we see because the U.S. has not really adopted a rights-based approach to these issues. We see in this country over a million people homeless on any given day, yet we see vacant houses all around us. We say that it's a clear violation of human rights when you have people on the streets while there's an empty home next to them, next door. We see cutbacks in public services that, right in the times of greatest crisis, and again, in a human rights-based system, we would not be cutting back those services right when people need them the most. And so we saw it as important as a national organization working for the right to housing to participate in this process because it does give us this unique opportunity to raise these issues on a national, on an international level, but hold our government accountable to these standards that we believe are essential and are the ones that the U.S. should be following.
Now, the entire report itself is very short. It's only 25 pages long. Will the U.S. have to present more concrete steps to end some of these shortcomings that it did admit to in the U.N. review?
The report is short in some ways by design. The process, the UPR process for Universal Periodic Review, requires every country in the world to be reviewed every 4 years. That's 190-some countries, and so the time for a review of each country is very short. And the way the process works is that each country produces its own 20-page report. Then the UN also produces two other reports. One is a 10-page summary of all the submissions of groups like ours, as well as other groups, and then a 10-page summary of all the recommendations and concerns that have been expressed by UN human rights monitors about the country in question over the past 4 years.
Now, in creating its report to the United Nations, did the government consult with groups here like your organization or give the public some kind of opportunity to provide input?
Yes, they did. That was one of the key parts of this Universal Periodic Review process, is that the UN requires the government to enable civil society participation in the reports. And the way that we got our government to do that was by hosting consultations, over 10 consultations all across the country, from New York, San Francisco, Albuquerque, New Mexico, an Indian reservation, New Orleans, Chicago, all across the country. These consultations were held where ordinary people as well as policy experts could participate and share what they felt were human rights violations going on in this country. And that's actually, while we saw that as a fantastic advantage of the process, something that was completely unprecedented, it also leads to a little bit of our disappointment in the way the report turned out. After hearing the painful personal stories of people losing their housing, living on the streets, from policy experts detailing how the housing crisis is affecting millions of people across the country, for the government to then, in its report, merely say that, there is a great rate of home ownership in the U.S., but we need to do more to preserve affordable housing, seems to be dismissing all those concerns that they heard. And so our group is just disappointed in that outcome, and we would want to hold the government accountable to the concerns that were expressed by all those people all across the country and say, an adequate self-reflection would at least acknowledge that there is a housing crisis going on in this country and set forth more of this concretely the steps that they're going to take to address it.
Now, who actually creates the report in the government? Is it some kind of a particular agency within the government that is tasked with doing this?
Because it's a UN process, the State Department takes the lead role in drafting the report. But one of the kind of unique features of this report and one thing that we're very much trying to encourage is the fact that because even though it's dealing with this international agency, with the UN, all of the details about the report of how human rights are enjoyed here at home are things that are addressed by all of the domestic agencies, by Housing and Urban Development, the Department of Justice, Department of Education, Department of Labor. So they were required to work with each of these other agencies in drafting the report, and they actually brought staff people from each of these agencies to these consultations across the country. And again, this is an unprecedented step where we see this human rights conversation not just being held in the State Department, but as a conversation about what's going on here domestically. And that's what we want to talk about. We want to talk about the enjoyment of human rights here at home, and we need to have that conversation with those domestic agencies in order to do that, not just keep the conversation in Geneva, but bring it home into each of our communities.
I'm speaking with Eric Tarz, Human Rights Program Director and Children and Youth Staff Attorney at the National Law Center on Homelessness and Poverty. He joins us from D.C., and we're talking about the United Nations Universal Periodic Review, which began in 2006, that the UN Human Rights Council was created in 2006, and the U.S., along with all of the other 191 member states of the UN, are tasked with submitting a self-evaluation of the state of human rights in their country every 4 years, and that then gets reviewed by a subset of member nations. The U.S. will have its review this November, its first review, in fact. Now, let's have that conversation on the state, in particular, of homelessness in the United States, particularly since the economic crash. In the Housing Coalition's report to the United Nations, there was one important point that said, in no U.S. jurisdiction can a person working full-time at the federal minimum wage afford a one-bedroom apartment, according to federal guidelines. That's a pretty staggering fact.
It definitely is. It's the core of the homelessness crisis and of the broader housing crisis. Our cities continue to encourage the development of high-income luxury apartments and condominiums while not planning adequately for the development of more affordable housing, and thus the consequence we see is the fact that, you know, even people who are working full-time can become homeless, are living in very precarious situations where they're just one paycheck or one medical bill away from homelessness themselves. And a human rights perspective on housing would say that the government needs to take active steps to address this, that through things like the creation of more public housing or Section 8 vouchers, but also inclusionary zoning mechanisms where the every new development is required to have a certain percentage of affordable units. These are all steps to make the right to housing real.
Go ahead. Finish your thought.
Right where you are in Los Angeles, this past year, we saw a huge effort put on by the LA Community Action Network and other groups to try to stop the rent increase in rent-stabilized apartments, because even though income and wages have actually gone down over the past year, the rents automatically go up each year, and they were calling for a rent moratorium as we go through this economic crisis. Unfortunately, the city council turned that down. But they are going to be coming back in the fall with a new proposal to try to peg the rent increases to the consumer price index. And this we see as a very concrete way of making the right to housing real, making sure that people's rents track the actual wages that they're making, and they'll be continuously affordable to them.
So since the housing bubble crashed and since the economic recession hit, how do you summarize what the U.S. government has actually done to address the incredible crisis in the public? There have been, of course, a number of bills passed that have had aspects of them devoted to alleviating the housing crisis. But how do you summarize for our listeners the government's response in general to the housing crisis?
There's a lot that the government has done right. There's a lot of pieces in place. The Hearth Act, which was passed last year, included a lot of new funding for different housing programs, expanded the definition of homelessness to include more groups so that more people are have access to different housing programs. And just this past May, we have, for the first time, federal strategic plan to end homelessness, which also calls for additional programs as well as continued collaboration between different government agencies to address the problem of homelessness. So there is a lot of good stuff that's going on. Unfortunately, all of these programs continue to be under-enforced, under-implemented, and most concerning, underfunded. We know the scope of the housing crisis in America. We have the tools to make it work, but we just aren't putting it in place in adequate amounts to actually end the problem of homelessness rather than just allowing it to continue in, you know, somewhat lesser degrees than it might otherwise be.
Well, finally, why don't you tell us what exactly your organization does recommend and, you know, what you would like to hear the United States say that it will do to the United Nations this November in terms of concrete steps to improve the situation of homelessness and to try to really end the housing crisis?
Well, there's kind of three key points. The first would be that we should not make the problem worse. The criminalization of homelessness is a completely backward step in trying to address the homelessness crisis. Rather than arresting people who are homeless for minor violations such as littering and jaywalking, as happens to very high extent in LA's Skid Row, we should be housing people. It costs cities $75 to $100 a day to arrest a person, put them in jail, when the cost of permanent supportive housing is only $25 a day. So, you know, it's not only the wrong thing to do, it's a fiscally irresponsible thing to do in times of crisis like these. The second thing would be to stop allowing people to be homeless on the streets when there are vacant homes around them. There are programs that allow for vacant properties, vacant federal properties, as well as state and local properties, to be used for housing for homeless people. We think these programs should be expanded, should be more programs like them should be implemented at the local level, as well as federal programs that are already in existence should be expanded in order to meet the need. And then the third thing is to stop the cutting public housing and housing subsidy budgets while the crisis continues. You know, we still have the need for more affordable housing, and communities aren't creating it. Public housing and Section 8 are kind of our last backstop to prevent the crisis from getting worse.
Well,
and all of these things will be discussed at our National Forum on the Human Right to Housing on October 13th and 14th in Washington, D.C., and I would definitely encourage folks to go to our website, which is nlchp.org, to register and to find out more information about how they can make the right to housing real in their community.
That's nlchp.org. Eric Tarz, I want to thank you very much for joining us today.
Thank you so much.
Eric Tarz is the Human Rights Program Director and Children and Youth Staff Attorney with the National Law Center on Homelessness and Poverty. Again, their website is nlchp.org. And we've been he's been helping us evaluate the U.S.'s recent report that it filed earlier this year, but just made publicly available on August 23rd to the United Nations Human Rights Council. This is Uprising, and later in the hour, we'll take a look at the Chicano moratorium, which happened 40 years ago this weekend, as well as the death of Ruben Salazar and the mystery that has surrounded his death for the past 40 years. We'll also hear this week's Black Agenda report on Nigeria and oil exploration. After this short break, we'll speak with journalist Jordan Flaherty about his new book, Floodlines, Community and Resistance from Katrina to the Gina 6. And by the way, a quick news update. Yesterday, we brought you a report from the actions outside Century Plaza, where a number of janitors with SEIU are on a 72-hour hunger strike to protest the laying off of 16 of their fellow workers from a building owned by J.P. Morgan Chase. Yesterday afternoon, hundreds of janitors and their families and supporters held a rally and then blocked traffic on Avenue of the Stars to draw attention to their struggle. Police reported that they arrested 13 people who were blocking the busy street. The janitors plan to end their hunger strike at 1 p.m. this afternoon. This is Uprising. We'll be right back.
KPFK joins the Ford Amphitheater in presenting its summer season 2010 Under the Stars.
This is Erica Bowick from Grandeza Mexicana Folk Ballet, and on Saturday, August 28th, we will celebrate the 100th anniversary of the Mexican Revolution with an explosion of dance and mariachi, recounting this tumultuous and empowering event in Mexican history. The ballet is brought to life with the music of Mariachi Nuevo Cuicatlán and Harmonies Choir, and will burst onto the stage of the Ford Amphitheater at 7:30 p.m. Located off the 101 freeway just south of Universal Studios, the Ford opens its doors 2 hours hours early for picnicking. That's the Grandeza Mexicana Folk Ballet, honoring the 100th year anniversary of the Mexican Revolution on Saturday, August 28th at 7:30 p.m. Further details and ticket information available on kpfk.org or by calling the Ford Box Office at 323-461-3673. KPFK is a proud media sponsor.
The Ford Summer Season. More details at kpfk.org.
Ghost of Congo Square by Terence Blanchard from his album A Tale of God's Will, A Requiem for Katrina. 5 years ago on Monday, August 29th, Hurricane Katrina made landfall on the southeast coast of Louisiana, causing severe infrastructure damage, but not directly causing any loss of life. However, extensive damage to the levees protecting the city of New Orleans from post-hurricane floods triggered a post-storm disaster that few expected. As flood levels rose in the city in the days following the storm, thousands of residents who either chose to stay or could not afford to evacuate were trapped. The ensuing disaster eventually killed nearly 2,000 people and became a low point in President George W. Bush's tenure, as the federal government's response, or lack thereof, did little to alleviate the situation. With mass media coverage portraying the majority black residents of New Orleans as looters and rapists, Katrina became a symbol of the worst of the U.S.'s racism, institutionalized and otherwise. 5 years later, residents of the city still wait for relief. Many are separated from family members after having been forced to relocate. Suicide rates are up, as are diagnoses of substance abuse and post-traumatic stress disorder. With this year's oil spill from the exploded offshore oil rig operated by BP, the Gulf Coast has once more been set back from its recovery efforts. Yet in the nexus of so much tragedy, community activism and resistance that has been part of the heart and soul of New Orleans has risen up to the challenge. In a new book called Floodlines, Community and Resistance from Katrina to the Gina 6, New Orleans-based journalist and Katrina survivor Jordan Flaherty paints a vivid and loving picture of how ordinary people and longtime activists have worked against all odds to attempt to rebuild one of the U.S.'s most unique cities. Joining me now live from New Orleans is Jordan Flaherty. Welcome to Uprising.
Thank you so much, Sonali. It's a pleasure to be here and an honor.
Well, it's an amazing book. Congratulations on publishing it. The name of the book is Floodlines, Community and Resistance from Katrina to the Gina 6. And I want to start where you start in your book, which is the culture of New Orleans, which is such an important part of the story and something that people who've never been to New Orleans just don't get. Before Hurricane Katrina hit, New Orleans was a city where most people lived for generations without leaving, more so than any other city in the U.S., and people have a very, very strong sense of cultural identity that goes back to the history itself of the city. Can you paint a picture for our listeners of how the culture of New Orleans has played a very strong role in the way in which people have begun rebuilding their communities?
You know, I was a community organizer before I moved to New Orleans, but I feel like I didn't really understand community or organizing before coming here and seeing the way in which these communities have come together and have organized for generations to fight against racism and white supremacy and for civil rights in the city. You know, a lot of this culture came up, these images that we've seen in that television, the HBO show Tremé, these images of Mardi Gras Indians or Second Line, socially and pleasure clubs, really arose as a response to white supremacy and as a way of preserving often African cultural traditions. And the fact that you had freed Africans in New Orleans having their own communities as early as the 1730s because of the sort of different way that colonialism took its form under the French colonial system, you had these communities really able to preserve their culture and seeing the preservation of that culture as a form of resistance. And after Katrina, these same communities really worked independently to bring their community home. So, for example, these social aid and pleasure clubs, these community institutions that were formed in the Reconstruction era to benefit the community and also preserve the culture, really worked to bring the people from their club and therefore from their neighborhood back to the city after Katrina, when the federal government, the state government, the city government, all government systems really failed them, but they worked as a community to bring people back.
Now, how did the national media's lack of understanding of New Orleans and its culture and community contribute to the extremely biased reporting that we saw in the wake of Katrina?
You know, the media really let us down, and it began just a couple days after Katrina, where suddenly the focus shifted from, how awful this storm and how awful this flooding to, oh, everyone left in the city are looters. Chris Lauren, speaking on CNN, said there's no one normal left in the city, just armed people. And while he was saying that, there was a shot of black folks at the Superdome. So this conversation shifted where suddenly everyone left in the city was a looter, was a criminal. You had Governor Blanco saying we're sending in troops, they're locked and loaded, they've been trained to shoot to kill, and I expect they will. You had the second in command of the police department, Warren Riley, saying to officers basically that they could shoot and kill whoever they wanted. It was up to their own conscience. He said, if you can sleep with yourself at night, then do it. So this atmosphere created this criminalization of the city that in a way continues today. And that's why, you know, there was so little opposition even to the tearing down of the public housing developments in the city, because there was this idea these were the same criminals and we had to destroy their houses to keep them from coming back. It became the survival of the system, the survival of the fittest system, where those with the most resources to begin with had the most resources to come back, and those that needed the most got the least.
Now, in terms of the impact of the flood on the people of New Orleans, I mentioned New Orleans is a city where people had, before the flood, lived for generations without leaving, more so than any other city in the United States. And how much more severe was the impact of the flooding on people who had such deep roots to their community? And how is the state of that community today? Is there a sort of post-Katrina diaspora of New Orleans residents around the country that have still not gone back home?
There absolutely is. The people were dispersed to 5,500 cities in all 50 states. At this point, there's at least 100,000 still dispersed. The way we count that is the pre-Katrina population was about 465,000. The current population is about 355,000. So that's the minimum of 100,000, but clearly included in that 355,000 are new residents, people that didn't live here pre-Katrina. No one's done a really accurate counting of how many that is, but a good estimate would be another 50,000. So that's 150,000 people dispersed. A recent survey of those dispersed found that 75% of African Americans who remained dispersed from New Orleans want to come back but felt they were being kept away from economic issues, whether that's because they still haven't been able to rebuild their home or because they don't have a job for when they get back or they don't feel that they have transportation even to get them back. The people that were taken out of New Orleans in those days after Katrina were given a one-way ticket to anywhere from Houston to Utah to Oregon to Maine, and that one way, you know, they just never received a ticket back, and it was just one of the many obstacles for the teachers. Every staff person of the teachers union, which was the largest union in the city, the biggest source of black middle-class political power in the city, that every single teacher, every single staffer in the public school system was fired. So many ways that this disproportionately affected African Americans. You just had a judge ruling last week that the Road Home program, which was the state-administered program to dole out $11 billion of federal funding, they found this program was racially discriminatory, that basically the funding that people got to rebuild was based on the value of their home. So wealthier, mostly whiter neighborhoods received more money to rebuild than poor African-American neighborhoods. The fact that housing values were lower even for the same style house in the same kind of neighborhood, if it was an African-American neighborhood versus a white neighborhood, that unfairness was replicated in the program so that white folks got more money to rebuild than black folks.
I'm speaking with Jordan Flaherty. He's a writer and a community organizer based in New Orleans, where he joins us from right now. And we're talking about his book, Floodlines, Community and Resistance from Katrina to the Gina 6. Eve Ensler has called it a people's history of the storm. And of course, we are right on the eve of the fifth anniversary of Hurricane Katrina. Let's talk about the way in which people began rebuilding almost immediately, the way in which people came together because of how so many New Orleans residents are so tied to their community and are organizers. There were a couple of organizations that you talk about that, and I also recall, came to light right after the storm hit. Common Ground was one of them, the Common Ground Relief Collective, and then the People's Hurricane Relief Fund and Oversight Committee. How did these two organizations figure into the rebuilding efforts?
Well, those were the two main organizations that were seen as progressive or radical and also were willing to accept mass numbers of volunteers. So they certainly had the widest national reputation because people came in droves into these organizations. Common Ground basically was formed in this period right after the storm where former Black Panther Malik Rahim, living in the West Bank neighborhood of New Orleans, was seeing white vigilantes roaming the streets. And especially because of that situation, he specifically put out the call to anybody, but especially to white activists to come, with the idea that if these young white activists came, they could help stand as a barrier between these racist white vigilantes and African-American community members. So the initial folks that came to Common Ground were mainly white activists, and I think that kind of replicated itself as the organization continued, became seen as a mostly, although certainly not entirely, white organization, while People's Hurricane Relief Fund from the beginning had a lot of Black nationalist supporters, although certainly not entirely, and I think it became the organization of choice for a lot of more African-American and other people of color communities, came through PHRF. So there was a certain amount of ways in which those different communities sought out those different organizations. But they both really were struggling to redefine progressive responses to disaster. Common Ground was really trying to reshape what relief looked like, and their slogan was solidarity, not charity. So they, their mission was to really break out of the charity model and to really be critical of how Red Cross and other organizations were handling this disaster, which I think that's such an important discussion to at least have begun. And I don't think we've answered that yet, but it's so important to be questioning these mainstream unaccountable organizations like Red Cross. People's Hurricane Relief Fund was, and there are certainly many overlaps between the two organizations, but People's Hurricane Relief Fund was less interested in service providing and more interested in direct action. And as the organization continued over time, they were more interested in building international links, in really trying to be the sort of one-stop organization for all of these issues, whether it's criminal justice, whether it's housing, whether it's education, to really bring in activism on these issues. And certainly PHRF also did service providing, they also did house gutting and all these things, but they came in with these different focuses and with a different base of volunteers. And the case study of how those different paradigms played out, I think, is really interesting. And there's a lot, both in their successes and failures, for people in the left to learn from.
One of the chapters in your book is The Rest of the World Lives Here Too, Immigrant Struggles. New Orleans is often thought of as a majority Black city, but it is also a city of immigrants, particularly after the flood, when a lot of immigrant labor was brought in to help rebuild. What are some of the untold stories from that community that you discuss in your book?
You know, I talk about, as you mentioned, the Latino community after the storm. I also talk about the Vietnamese community and the Arab community in New Orleans. And I wish that chapter were five times as long, because there's so much I could say. And I feel like, even I just really touched the surface of it. But there is so much important that went on. The some of the best organizing or most exciting organizing that happened among the new Latino immigrants was by an organization called the Workers' Center for Racial Justice, which was both working with the H-2B visa workers, the so-called guest workers, to organize among those folks who were brought in. They paid oftentimes thousands or even tens of thousands of dollars to get this temporary visa to work, and then were basically oftentimes treated to modern-day slavery by their employers who seized their passports and, you know, gave them less pay than they had been promised, were basically renting them out to other employers. At the same time, the Workers' Center for Racial Justice was also organizing among the day labor community who were facing, basically were locked into this paradigm that they did not choose, where they were pitted against black workers. The way Sackett Sony, organizer of the Workers' Center for Racial Justice, put it is Latino workers were locked in and African-American workers were locked out. So the Latino workers were locked into to wage theft and to poor wages and inappropriate or lack of safety protection when they're in these gutted homes and other dangerous circumstances. Meanwhile, African-American workers were locked out of these jobs, were kept out of these jobs, and the two workforces were being pitted against each other. And a lot of the work of the Workers' Center for Racial Justice was to try and build unity in these communities and see how they were both being basically oppressed by the same forces that were trying to profit off of this disaster. A lot of these contractors and subcontractors and sub-subcontractors that were profiteering off of this. And of course, there were many employers in both situations who were also doing the right thing, but there was also so much wage theft and so much oppression that they were facing. Mm. The Vietnamese community, very briefly, was a very interesting story of how this community that had really seen itself as sort of libertarian and outside of the system and not interested in engaging. Katrina was really a wake-up call for that community and really showed members of that community how important it was to build coalitions with the African-American community and that political engagement was important, and the shifts that happened in that community were really interesting and exciting.
Now, Jordan, finally, FEMA Director Michael Brown resigned just within a couple of weeks after the hurricane hit. He was, of course, the director of FEMA under Bush. He now hosts a radio show in Denver, and he's doing a special show from New Orleans this weekend to commemorate the tragedy. And looks like he's still shirking his responsibility in the whole mess. He's blaming Bush and Mayor Ray Nagin. What do you think?
You know, it's really comical, and I saw him in the Spike Lee documentary as well, where, you know, he's also pointing the finger at Michael Chertoff and saying he was unqualified. And of course, Chertoff was unqualified, and Bush was unqualified, and Nagin certainly could have done better. But, Michael Brown was also terribly unqualified, right? His previous job was head of the Arabian Horse Association, I believe. Incredibly unqualified. We were really let down by every layer of government, and you know, it's part of the natural continuation, the natural result of these policies of the Bush administration that really were, in many ways, a continuation of the Clinton administration and of the Reagan administration, this idea of shrinking government, right? So Chief Bush Advisor Grover Norquist once said, "We want government to be so small that you could drown it in a bathtub." And that's what Katrina saw, the natural result of these policies. We saw government being made completely ineffectual and useless.
And in fact, Michael Brown is saying that the reason why there was such a disaster in terms of the U.S.'s response was because of big government. Well, Jordan Flaherty, I want to thank you very much for joining us today. Best of luck to you. And what's the website for your book?
Floodlines.org.
That's floodlines.org, and I certainly recommend it to listeners. Thanks so much, Jordan. Best of luck.
Thank you so much.
Jordan Flaherty is the author of Floodlines, Community and Resistance from Katrina to the Gina 6. Again, the website is floodlines.org. By the way, Uprising is about to launch an outreach program to help increase our listenership throughout Southern California. A great way to raise awareness of the issues that we cover every single day, including the ones that you heard this morning, is to simply turn more folks onto our program. Whether you live in San Diego or Santa Barbara or Riverside or Santa Monica, you can help by volunteering just a few hours. We're hoping to have folks help us pass out literature about KPFK and Uprising in classrooms, union halls, farmers markets, and more. If you're interested in being part of our outreach team, email us at mail@uprisingradio.org or call Jesse at 818-985-2711, extension 513. Up next, the Black Agenda Report. Glenn Ford is a writer and radio commentator and the executive editor of the Black Agenda Report. This week's commentary is on Nigeria and oil exploration.
In July of last year, Amnesty International released a report documenting the vast environmental and human rights degradations imposed on the people of the Niger River Delta by 50 years of oil exploration and production. Amnesty International sent a letter to Peter Voser, the newly appointed CEO of Royal Dutch Shell, the dominant company in the Delta oil fields, asking him to come clean on the failures and poor practice of both Shell and the Nigerian government. A little over a year later, Royal Dutch Shell and the Nigerian government have presented their answer in the form of a monstrous whitewash produced in collusion with an agency of the United Nations. The United Nations Environmental Program study, which was paid for by Shell Oil, rewrites history to blame 90% of the region's pollution on spills caused by local people tapping into oil pipelines and from sabotage by guerrilla groups. The United Nations agency admits that it only studied 300 petroleum spill sites on a list that was given to it by Shell Oil and vouched for by Shell's partners in the Nigerian government. The true scope of Niger River Delta pollution is catastrophic, with the equivalent of 9 to 13 million barrels of oil fouling the waterways, farmlands, and mangrove forests of Africa's largest wetland. That's at least twice as much oil as escaped in the recent Gulf of Mexico disaster, thus ranking Nigeria and Shell as the number one oil polluters in the world. Now the two super polluters try to blame the people for their own half century of crimes. The UN agency is now backtracking, claiming its study is not yet done and there will be no report until early next year. The figures used in the study, the UN says, are the responsibility of the Nigerian government and Shell Oil. And if that is the case, then the study has no credibility whatsoever. 27 years ago, the Nigerian National Petroleum Corporation itself noted the slow poisoning of the waters and the destruction of vegetation and agricultural land by oil spills which occur during petroleum operations. The 1983 report declared that since the inception of the oil industry in Nigeria more than 25 years ago, there has been no concerned and effective effort on the part of the government, let alone the oil operators, to control environmental problems associated with the industry. Thus, 27 years ago, the oil companies and the government had already been committing environmental crimes against the people of the Niger River Delta for a quarter of a century. It is commonly accepted that oil tapping by local people and guerrilla sabotage are relatively recent phenomena. Shell Oil and the Nigerian government have no shame. Delta residents fear the UN report will be used as an excuse for stepped-up Nigerian government military operations in the region. There is also good reason to worry that the United States might seize on the UN report to add an environmental justification for its expanding military activities in West Africa. The United Nations, once the hope of the planet, has in this instance attempted to facilitate a corporate government cover-up of monumental dimensions. But the evidence cannot be hidden. It oozes from every nook and cranny of the Niger River Delta, and the people know how it got there. For Black Agenda Radio, I'm Glenn Ford.
Visit www.blackagendareport.com for more information. You're listening to Uprising. I'm your host, Sonali Gohatkar. Earlier this year, the Los Angeles Times requested records from the LA County Sheriff's Office relating to the shooting death of its columnist, Ruben Salazar, 40 years ago. months after the California Public Records Act request was filed and after initially denying the request, Sheriff Lee Baca announced this week that he would turn over thousands of pages of information to the County Office of Independent Review, a civilian watchdog agency. Ruben Salazar was also the news director at KMEX TV and was killed in Silver Dollar Bar in Whittier when a tear gas canister shot by a sheriff's deputy hit him in the head. His death happened during the August 29, 1970 National Chicano Moratorium. Salazar was in the Silver Dollar Bar taking a break from his reporting. The Chicano Moratorium galvanized over 30,000 Chicanos to protest the Vietnam War. In 1995, The Times reported that only 3 days prior to his death, Salazar had confided to friends of his fears that the police may try to discredit him due to his work uncovering police brutality in the Mexican-American community on the East Side. Ruben Salazar's death has since been clouded in controversy and speculation. Local activists are marking the 40th anniversary of the 1970 Chicano moratorium with a protest this Saturday in East Los Angeles to call for an end to the wars in Afghanistan and Iraq, an end to military recruiting targeting Latino and immigrant youth, and for an investigation into Ruben Salazar's death. Joining me in studio this morning is Carlos Montes. He is with the August 29th Chicano Moratorium Organizing Committee, and he is also with the Community Service Organization and Fight Back News. Welcome to Uprising.
Good morning, Sonali. It's great to be here.
And with us on the phone is Robert Lopez. He is an LA Times reporter who has been covering the effort to get the information from the sheriff's office about Ruben Salazar. Welcome to Uprising, Robert.
Good morning. How are you?
Doing very well. Thanks so much for joining us. Robert, I'd like to start with you. Why is the LA Times so interested in getting these documents from the sheriff's office? What do you think is in them?
Well, the LA Times has been interested in this for a number of years. I first filed a number of requests for the Salazar files in the late 1990s. I made requests with the LAPD, the FBI, the CIA, the ATF, and the LA sheriffs at the time. I wrote a 3,200-word piece, I guess it would have been on the 25th anniversary, about the last days of Ruben Salazar, and quoted some of his closest friends and colleagues who told me at the time that he believed he was being followed by police. I reported how police had visited him at the news station at KMEX during the middle of an aggressive investigation by his news crews into the killing of two Mexican nationals by LAPD officers downtown. I also reported that his reporter, William Restrepo, told me that they were investigating allegations of brutality by police officers and sheriff's deputies on the East Side, and that they believed that the law enforcement officials had found out about what they were doing. So they were concerned. So obviously that piqued my interest, and I filed another request with the Sheriff's Department again this year, seeking to see if they had anything, and this time I was told ultimately they had 8 boxes of documents. So it's a newsworthy story. He was an LA Times reporter. It's a killing that has left a wound that has yet to heal 40 years later. There are so many questions surrounding his death because the inquest that was conducted at the time by the coroner's office really never investigated a lot of key questions, such as what was the department policy regarding the use of tear gas projectiles? As you recall, this sheriff's deputy who fired that missile did so at a time when the department also had less lethal cardboard canisters. Instead, he chose to use a 10-inch torpedo-shaped pointed projectile with fins that went through a thin curtain in the bar. The deputies claimed during the inquest they told people to get out of the bar because they had received reports of an armed gunman inside. Yet 4 people testified who were inside the bar that they never heard any such order and, in fact, were pushed back in the bar by gun-wielding deputies. And there's also photos that seem to corroborate this. William Restrepo, Salazar's reporter, who was in the bar with Salazar, told me, and again told me yesterday I spoke with him at length for a story that will be appearing this weekend in the Times, that they were being followed by sheriffs down Whittier Boulevard, and they heard no such commands, and they were just extremely worried about the whole situation and days unfolding as the moratorium was scheduled to begin on August 29th, 1970. Mm-hmm. So it's a great story. It's a story that has extreme relevance to the city of Los Angeles. It's a story that's important in the minds of many members of the Latino community and other people as well. And it's something that we need to pursue, and I'm glad I'm doing it. And I'm glad the newspaper is behind my efforts.
Well, I want to turn now to Carlos Montes. In your mind, what was the significance of Ruben Salazar and his work? He wasn't just a journalist. He was a groundbreaking journalist.
Groundbreaking journalist. He talked about issues that were relevant to us, but he was a victim of police repression like many of us were. It's our position that he was taken out by the sheriffs because of what he was writing about. We were victims of police provocateurs, infiltrations, indictments.
And I should say you were involved in the original organizing around the Chicano moratorium,
Right, moratorium. Exactly. I was arrested. I was beaten in the county jail. I was threatened with my life. I left the country and I went underground, as many of us had to do. So for him to be a well-known journalist in the public eye, The sheriff wanted to neutralize him, and my position that he was killed intentionally by the sheriffs. The eyewitnesses indicate that they were trying to get out of the bar, that Restrepo, his reporter with him, had IDs on him. They're trying to get out of the bar. There's pictures that Raul Reese took that day showing people trying to get out of the bar, and they were pushed back in there. So Restrepo indicated they identified themselves as reporters. They had ID. They were pushed back in. The tear gas projectile, missile projectile, wasn't a canister. Like Roberto said, went right through the. It was open door. It was a glass window. He was shot in the head. Okay.
Well, I want to ask you, Robert Lopez, what you make of the offer by Sheriff Lee Baca to turn over the documents to this independent agency, and then I believe it's a report that they will come up with that you will get to see finally.
I requested all the documents in their possession in my California Public Records Act request. I asked for 16-millimeter footage that was shot by the sheriffs that day. I asked for memos. I asked for notations. And, you know, that's what I want. And I'm hoping that ultimately I get those documents.
And so the LA Times will continue to pursue to actually get the actual documents and not a summary of them.
Well, you know, my request was for the documents, and that's, you know, what I'm hoping to get. And I don't want to jump ahead of myself or the situation here. Mm-hmm. I'm waiting to see, you know, what happens, and then I'll continue at that point. As Carlos said, it was a very turbulent era. I mean, I've got hundreds and hundreds of pages of FBI documents, probably, I think, from 1965 to about 71, and they definitely do indicate, you know, there was infiltrators, provocateurs. It was a very turbulent time, not only in the East Side, but, you know, across the United States.
That's right.
And, you know, it's, as I said, a very important piece of L.A. history. And as Carlos pointed out, Ruben Salazar was a trailblazer. He was a groundbreaking journalist. He was a guy who was doing investigative reporting long before Watergate, long before Woodward and Bernstein. I think in some ways he really has never gotten the full recognition.
Well,
as the great investigative reporter that he was,
cool.
He certainly was doing that type of reporting.
Right. He has gotten his face on a U.S. stamp, right?
Yeah.
And
years later, right?
Well, yeah. I'm speaking with Robert Lopez, LA Times reporter, Carlos Montes, who is one of the original Chicano Moratorium organizers. He's also with the August 29th Chicano Moratorium Organizing Committee. It's the 40th anniversary this weekend. And Carlos, let's talk about what's happening this weekend and how so many of the goals, or some of the goals, particularly relating to war and the targeting of youth, are still on your agenda 40 years later.
Absolutely, absolutely.
It's another war. It's a different country, but it's still war.
Different country, but the military still targets our youth for recruiting. They try to recruit us, you know, pushing us out of high school, recruit us into the military. They're still doing that. They're still doing that in the barrio and the ghettos, trying to recruit black and the Chicano youth into the military. They target the East Side. The East Side has the largest recruiting center in Southern California. We're saying no to the recruiters and no to the U.S. imperialist wars. We're going to be marching down the middle of Wheeler Boulevard. We'll pass the old Silver Dollar area where Ruben was killed. We'll stop there to honor his legacy and his work. and we'll have a mass rally at Salazar Park. We'll be starting at the corner of First and Mednick in Belvedere Park. We'll assemble between 9 and 10, start marching at 10:30. The rally will be at 12:30. We'll have speakers and music. We're inviting everyone to come out.
And that's all happening on Saturday?
On Saturday, August 28th in
East
LA.
Is there a website people can find out more information?
They can go to fightbacknews.org, where we have articles on there, and we have, our Facebook, Chicano Moratorium, and they can call me at 213-712-0370, send me a message or a text. And we're saying demand that District Attorney Steve Cooley investigate what we call is the murder of Ruben Salazar and to prosecute the sheriffs that committed this atrocity against our people. We see it as police repression against the Chicano people and our struggle for equality and self-determination, similar to what happened May 1st at MacArthur Park. It happened to us 40 years ago, and they continue to try to put us down, whether it's Arizona or East LA. We're going to continue to fight back and organize and demand equality and self-determination.
Well, you can find out all the information about this weekend's activities around the 40th anniversary commemoration of the Chicano Moratorium at fightbacknews.org. Robert Lopez, I'm assuming LATimes.org is the best place to read your writings?
Yeah, if you go to LATimes.com, actually, and just
put LATimes.com.
They'll all pop up, and every one of those articles should have hyperlinks to some of the older pieces, the rather long column one feature I did on the 25th anniversary of Salazar's death, which really goes into length about his final days and the inquest that has left so much unresolved. And then there's also a link to the article on the FBI files. And I finally got after about nearly a six-year wait. I wrote a story on that.
Yeah. Well, we'll link to some of those on our website as well. Robert Lopez, thank you so much for joining us. Carlos Montes, thank you as well, and best of luck to both of you.
Thank you, Sonali.
Thank you.
For Sonali's subversive thought for the day, Robert Penn Warren once said, "History cannot give us a program for the future, but it can give us a fuller understanding of ourselves and of our common humanity so that we can better face the future." That's Robert Penn Warren. That's Sonali's subversive thought for the day. You've been listening to Uprising. Martina Steiner is our interim assistant producer. Teddy Robinson is our engineer. Our website is uprisingradio.org. I'm your host and producer, Sonali Kolhatkar. Thanks so much for listening. I'll see you Monday at 8. Have a wonderful weekend.